Okay. Hi, I'm Dan Rector. I'm the chair of this session. And welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming. Speaker this evening is Mario DePillis. Mario has been a student of Mormon community for many years. Wrote a pioneering work on the subject. I don't know how long ago it was, but quite some years ago, and has been an observer of Mormons and really a champion of Mormon community over the years. Many of you may be familiar with this Pat Bagley illustrated magazine, which has as the cover article Mario's article on the persistence of Mormon community into the 1990s. Mario has had a couple of bonding experiences with us fairly recently. He spoke at our Plotting Zion conference, which dealt with Mormon community and was an important participant in that, and I believe that's where this paper was originally given. And then last, when was it? The Washington, D.C. symposium. In March, during the storm of the century, Mario was with the Washington, D.C. symposium, and the electricity went out and everything else happened that you can imagine during that storm, if you can recall. And they spent a lot of time singing hymns and having a wonderful communal experience there at that occasion as well. So this is a person who has both an academic and a personal experiential interest in Mormon community, and I'd like you to welcome Mario DePillis. I should give his academic credentials, I'm sorry. He's the Professor Emeritus of History at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. So.
Okay. Doesn't want to forget that ever. Academics are so important. Everybody's a victim today. Oliver North was a victim of President Reagan, and now he's running for Congress. Susan Lake is a victim of the Mormon Church and now has a bestseller book. And I'm a victim of, shall I say it, Albert Peck. Just as I was beginning to enjoy my summer, he calls me up. And I simply succumb to his relentless optimism and accepted the invitation to speak. One thing I'd like to make clear before I begin is, first, academic PhDs are not necessarily intellectuals. And second, for the first 10 minutes or so of this talk, I shall be saying some very uncomfortable things. If you are moved to jump up and run out, please be patient. I think the church is in a serious crisis today, and that the role and fate of intellectuals is intimately involved in that crisis. As always, in the history of mainline churches, the intellectuals are at the hub of discussions trying to influence the direction of the church in crisis. By historical research, by social and philosophical analyses, by investigative reporting, and even by conferences. As always, all religious intellectuals are threatened by two dangers, whether there is a crisis or not. One stems from their continuous search for truth, even when they deny that there is any such thing as truth. Unfortunately, their reasoning, their analysis, their study of evidence to discover the truth often uncovers what they see as contradictions or even official lies and cover-ups. The second danger arises because almost all intellectuals believe in some kind of ideology, even though they may deny it. And their reasoning over the evidence, their research, may threaten their own ideology and may shatter their own deeply held beliefs. If they are religious believers, they may risk a disconfirmation of their faith, and that can be devastating. In Mormon terms, they may lose their testimony, even their faith. And because the Mormon Church is a kind of communitarian, psychologically bounded society, Latter-day Saints find it more difficult to apostatize than do other Christian church members. In fact, mainline Christian churches no longer use the powerful old word apostate. And for Jews, the term apostate is totally irrelevant. The most alienated, non-observant Jews are the first to defend Judaism. What do today's believing intellectuals see as untruths and injustices perpetrated in the name of religion? We are all very familiar with present-day problems and issues, the ones that concern today's intellectuals. First, the church is guilty of that great modern form of untruth, the cover-up. The church, as you know, has covered up sexual abuses like child molestation, abuse of women, incest, and other heinous sins committed at the local level or even by religious authorities. Garden variety sins like adultery or theft can be covered up, of course, more easily, but do not seem to interest intellectuals. Second, if the church does admit to an error of judgment, it takes forever. Sometimes it makes the admission only indirectly. Thirdly, in administering their colleges and universities, the church is quite ready to deny tenure or simply to expel fine scholars, not for lack of publication or good teaching, but for ideological reasons. I won't name names. Many intellectuals in the church have protested, but to no avail. Fourthly, the head of the church has met with notorious right-wingers and held them in high repute. Public meetings with such figures and praise for them can give them a certain moral legitimacy. Praise from a church figure can subtly encourage believers to contribute money to political charlatans posing as moral reformers. Church leaders, especially since the McCarthyite and John Birch Society movements of the 1950s, have associated themselves with movements that American intellectuals had long since opposed and exposed and repudiated. Fifthly, the church crushes dissent, usually in subtle ways. Dissent is a favorite activity of intellectuals, and for some, I think it is the sole activity. The church likes to move against local dissent first, especially if a local leader takes an important unorthodox position. Sixth, there is that most problematic of all theological areas for activist intellectuals, sexuality. It is here that the fate of the intellectuals becomes intertwined with that of women and homosexuals. I have to say this because I have yet to meet a strong feminist woman in the church who was not an intellectual. And the very definition of what shall be the status of women and homosexuals in the church in the 1990s is the hottest topic in the church today, not just in theology, but in poetry, art, history, sociology, psychology, and even the biological sciences. Intellectuals who are feminists and homosexuals threaten patriarchy. Since we have been living in a new moral universe, to borrow the great phrase of Robert Owen, or an immoral universe in the opinion of some, created by the social revolution of the 1960s, the church has come down very hard on two forms of behavior. The church might properly call the first illicit sexual behavior, and the second illicit gender behavior. Thus, women who demand the priesthood or the right to be heard in deliberative assemblies are guilty of illicit gender behavior. They must stay in their place, which the patriarchy has defined as ordained by tradition and by God. Similarly, homosexuals, whom the church does not recognize as belonging to a separate gender, are guilty of illicit sexual behavior. As free agents, they have made immoral, sinful choices based on their psychological confusion, perhaps, but moral choices. As abnormal people, they cannot hold office in the church, though clearly some have, only to be quietly removed upon discovery. This area of sexuality is replete with many other examples of church oppression. The church has taken the most doctrinaire and even inhumane stands in dismissing homosexuality as abnormal and sinful. The church remains one of the few groups that still discourages marriage outside the group as less than holy and certainly not fully recognized. The church still considers masturbation as sinful, despite our modern understanding of the activity as a normal inclination of the young from birth, as Freud taught us and first observed, through adolescence. And finally, there is the greatest single moral issue of sexuality of our time, namely abortion. Abortion is a deadly evil, and anyone showing clear public sympathy with free choice in a woman's body would be in danger of excommunication. Ladies and gentlemen, I will let you in on a secret. The church